It's good to come together as God's people this morning to worship Him, and I really appreciate the worship that we've been getting led in this morning, just acknowledging Jesus as Lord. You'll know if you were here last week, we've been doing sort of what I call occasional sermons. Just means we're not locked into a series, and it gives me greater freedom to talk about things that are on my heart and sort of pressing on my mind. Last week I was told by a few people that it was intense, it was quite concentrated. Maybe I had too much to say in relation to it, but if you were here, you'll know what I was trying to say was that when the Baptist movement began, the founding fathers of this movement really wanted to draw a distinction between the Old Testament and the New Testament, and they wanted to say that there is a different kind of religion, there is a different kind of expression of relationship to God that occurs in the New Testament and not from the Old Testament. And that if our expression looks like the Old Testament, we've probably forgotten where Jesus is. If Christianity is propping up socio-political powers, or socio-political powers are using Christianity in the way that church and state were combined in the Old Testament and the king ran the nation and its religion, then there's an issue for us. And so the key question was, what difference does Jesus make? What difference does Jesus make? What difference did the coming of Jesus make in terms of the way that we express a relationship to God? What difference does Jesus make in terms of our lives? It's really important that as we come to Christmas, we consider that question. It's a question we should often be asking ourselves and challenging ourselves with. What difference is Jesus making in my life? As we come towards Christmas, to celebrate, ironically, Jesus' birth and incarnation, we should be asking ourselves, what difference does Jesus make in the way that we celebrate Christmas? This year again, we're going to have Just Christmas, where we're encouraging everyone to downsize your Christmas. This is something we probably should do in most aspects of our life, but let's especially do it at Christmas. And release monies. This week I was reading an article, and for those that don't know, but probably most of you do, iPhone have just released a phone. It's called iPhone 7. And I was reading an article just last week about the iPhone 8. And I was sitting there going, that's really weird, because my iPhone 4 is working great. and I was just sitting there. And the thing was, the week before I just bought my mum, or not bought my mum, I'd encouraged my mum to get a new phone contract because it was a really good deal and you're going to get a much better phone and all this. And then I sat down and thought about, actually, how much have we just spent on getting this new state-of-the-art phone that probably my mum didn't need, but I felt she probably should have it? And do you know what bricking it is? Well, almost last Sunday I was in a situation where it was like, oh, anyway, that's another story. But and I calculated, how much money have I just encouraged my mother to spend on this phone that she didn't have, because she was really happy with her old phone. But I thought, there's something pathological, isn't there? Something in our psyche. We're kind of locked into a materialistic way of doing stuff. And so just Christmas, and we release money to help people in CHO, working in CHO, which deals with human trafficking, and empowering people so that they don't have to sell their kids to be involved in human trafficking, and to make a difference. And we encourage people, lock out of the materialistic mindset and let Jesus make a difference this Christmas. And actually do Christmas differently. And so I'd encourage you again as you prepare for Christmas, and by the way, I'm not down on Christmas, I love Christmas, but think about doing it differently. Ask yourself that question, what difference does Jesus make? Now, the essence of you being here for the last couple of weeks as I've been wrestling with this question, these are random thoughts that I've kind of tied together, but they all basically relate to one thing, that the new covenant, the new thing that Jesus came to do, was that he moved faith from a matter of external constraints to a matter of the heart. The issue of the new covenant, and we see this over and over again, actually in these prophetic statements in the Old Testament about the new thing that Jesus is going to come and do. In the text that we read in Ezekiel, we have a very interesting reference to sprinkling with water. And I won't say maybe they got the idea of baptism, or John the Baptist got the idea of baptism there, but he may have. And you will be clean. But this water was a sign of the new covenant that was coming. And what was this new covenant going to be? He says, I will cleanse you from all your impurities and from all your idols. I will give you a new heart and put a new spirit in you. I will remove from you your heart of stone and give you a heart of flesh. And I will put my spirit in you and move you to follow my decrees. You see, a morality that is driven by the work of the Spirit through a transformed heart. Remember Jesus, and we read this a couple of weeks ago, in John 4, as he meets the woman at the well, he explains to her, he said, look, because when she gets caught out, she asks a religious question, which is usually what people do. I can tell you this as a minister. You see if they're swearing or they're talking to you in all sorts of ways, and then suddenly they discover you're a minister, they'll say something religious. Well, that's exactly what this woman does. She asks them a theological question. Where should we worship? Should we worship in Jerusalem, or should we worship on Mount Gerizim? Where should we build the temple? And Jesus says to her, he says, you don't understand. This new covenant that is about the heart, means that we're going to worship God in spirit and truth. And it's not going to be about physical temples anymore. It's going to be about the Spirit of God dwelling in his people. And that is going to be the temple of God, the new place where God's presence will be encountered. But it will begin with spirit and truth and your heart. I find it fascinating, and as I go on to do this talk this morning, that it is in relation to the issue of morality, and in a situation of morality where this woman has had five husbands and the guy she's living with is not her husband, that Jesus begins to talk about the intent of heart and what's happening in terms of this new covenant and the Spirit of God. We live in a world where Christian morality is subject to all kinds of assaults. I was going to ask for a video clip to be played of a ruling that was recently made, and it was something that I was going to preach on predominantly, but I sort of dealt with the church-state thing last week, so I'm going to move out from this. But I do want to mention this, the Asher cake case that occurred in Northern Ireland. Can we show the video? Is that possible? Is that one of those new phones?
We are extremely disappointed with today's ruling. If equality law means people can be punished for politely refusing to support other people's causes, then equality law needs to change. This ruling undermines democratic freedom, it undermines religious freedom, and it undermines free speech. We had served Mr. Lee before and would be happy to serve him again. The judges accepted that we did not know Mr. Lee was gay and that he was not the reason we declined the order. We have always said it. It was never about the customer, it was about the message, and the court accepted that today. But now we're being told that we have to promote the message, even if it's against our conscience. What we refused to do was to be involved with promoting a political campaign to change marriage law in Northern Ireland. Because we're Christians, we support the current law, and we felt that making this cake would make us responsible for its message. We wouldn't decorate a cake with a pornographic picture or with swear words. We wouldn't even decorate a cake with a spiteful message about gay people, because to do so would be to endorse and promote it. The court said the commission gave the impression it wasn't interested in assisting the faith community in issues like this. Well, I think a lot of people agree with that today, and that's certainly how we felt. We'll have to take advice from our lawyers about whether there's a way to appeal this ruling. And in the meantime, other businesses will have to take advice about whether they can refuse orders that conflict with their conscience, or whether they have to be coerced as well into promoting other people's views. We'd like to thank huge numbers of people all across the country who've been supporting us and praying for us through this. And we're very grateful to you all. It's been a trying time, but we're thankful to God and his faithfulness to us through everything. He is still on the throne. He is the ruler of heaven and of earth, and he is our God, and we worship and we honour him. Thank you.
The background to that video clip and that ruling, and some of you may have missed it, but the Ashers run a bakery in Belfast, and a gay activist came in and asked them to make a cake, which was fair enough. But the gay activist then asked them to inscribe on the cake the message that supported gay marriage, basically a slogan. And the Ashers, in good conscience, could not write that onto the cake. They said, you know, we can't support this. Our conscience won't allow us. We'll make you the cake, but we can't subscribe to this message, and therefore we'll give you your money back. And you can go. And that was taken to court. And what happened was, through a series of trials, is that the courts found against the couple. Now the ruling does all kinds of clever things in law that you can do, and I've read the ruling and I understand how they arrived at the ruling. But basically, everybody knows what this is doing. It is mandating someone to behave in a fashion and a matter of religion and faith in a way that is not in accordance with their conscience. And that is a scary ruling. Just so you know how scary it is, Peter Satchel, the leader of Stonewall, who has fought tirelessly in relation to gay rights in terms of Britain and this country, he came out and he said, this ruling is so wrong. He said, this is contrary to everything that we've been fighting against, because it is attacking the very heart of freedom of conscience and expression. And as Christians, we need to be aware that we're now moving in a very different world. And although at the moment that there is notionally a wall around faith communities, how long that will persist, I'm not sure. We're looking in the United States at the moment, and you know I talked last week, but they're talking about the conscription of members of the Islamic faith, creating a list of everybody who subscribes to Islamic faith. This is in the United States of America, where the founding fathers, who were influenced by Baptist ideas, affirmed religious freedom. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not a supporter of Islam, and Islam suppresses religion in all sorts of parts of the world, and we oppose that wholly, and I oppose that with every fiber in my being. But I worry about what we're seeing in terms of our Western democracies. I'm worried about what we're seeing in our countries as Christians, and we need to be aware of this stuff. But the question is, and it throws up a whole other load of issues about how we respond. I've spoken to some Christians, and because this was relating to same-sex relationships, people say, oh, well, what's the big deal? You know, the Christians just need to get over this. They just need to move on like we have. And you know, we've had dialogues in relation to this. And again, it raises the issues for us about our engagement as a church, as a community of God's people who are committed to the Bible, and how we engage with our society. Sort of stuff Judy was talking about today. And what does that look like? There's a worrying disintegration in our moral dialogue, and it's not just a disintegration within our society, it's actually also within the evangelical world. If you follow various feeds like I do on Twitter and things, you'll know that evangelicals have been beating themselves up over this Trump question, and there's been big issues about, is the term evangelical dead? Can we use it at all? Would you identify yourself as a conservative evangelical? I probably would, but the whole thing has become really heated, and issues of evangelical identity. But worse than this, and Steve Holmes, he's a Baptist lecturer who lectures up at St. Andrews University. He's just come back from the States in a conference there. And in America, he was promoting a book where four evangelicals were dialoguing the issue of same-sex relationships. And two were taking a conservative, traditionalist perspective on it, and two were taking a progressive view on it, and they were dialoguing it. And Steve Holmes was taking the conservative view, but what he was reflecting on was the way that the vitriolic that he received, because he actually acknowledged that those who were opposing him could still be Christians. And he actually detailed someone who came up to him and said, you know, you're just leading people to hell like they are. And he was reflecting on this and saying, you know, where do we find a common baseline that we can move forward as the Church of God, as evangelicals, even as conservative evangelicals? One of the things that we've seen, and I see the word of the year is post-truth. I haven't got time to go into all of this morning, but what happens in post-truth is that there is no such thing as truth. There is no such thing as right and wrong. There is no such thing as fact. There is just opinion, and the loudest opinion wins. Everything is a matter of one person's power over another. And you see the sort of political process that we've seen, which is just about denigration. And the thing is, in the Christian church, we do the same stuff. Where if somebody says, you know, I question that, or does the Bible really say this, or do we, what we do is we degenerate into name calling, and we silence people. But what happens is, in their hearts, there's other stuff going on. You would not believe the number of conversations that I have with people who say, you know, I'm struggling with this, but I can't tell my church this. You know, I have some questions here. And we have killed, to some extent, the ability to dialogue and discuss. Steve Holmes, he makes a brilliant point in the blog that he wrote about his experience. And obviously it was a big experience because he wrote the blog straight after getting off the plane. He says, you know, I'm a Protestant evangelical. Let's go to the next slide. And he says, you know, I believe in sola fides, which means faith alone. It was one of the great slogans of the Reformation. And it's a shared belief in the saving work of Jesus' death on the cross and humanity's need of that salvation. And there is our starting point, where we believe that what Christ did and Christ's work on the cross alone is the basis on which we approach God. It is the basis from which we begin to consider issues of Christian morality. Martin Luther, the great German reformer, he said, you know, Christianity is one beggar telling another beggar where to find bread. And unless we come at Christian morality with that sense of the shared experience of the cross of Jesus Christ, and the shared conviction that humanity is desperately in need of that, then actually all else fails. And I believe that there is a basis for unity amongst evangelicals in that declaration, in our affirmation of the centrality of the cross of Jesus Christ, the centrality of Jesus' work on the cross, and the centrality of the world's need to know that saving faith. Do we agree? So this said, how is that salvation, how is that conviction to be worked out in a 21st century context? You know, the last 20 or 30 years has seen massive shifts that I would not anticipate in my lifetime. I think someone was saying it was 25 years since the Berlin Wall came down. And I remember when I saw that and I thought, I'll never see anything more significant than this in my life. Hey, who knows? I've seen thing after thing, and we've seen shifts, and we've seen massive shifts in our society, and we have seen shifts within the church community, and significant shifts within the Christian community in terms of sexual ethics. And the reality is that the world around us has changed, but the church is also having and struggling to deal with these changes. We can opt for disengagement. Okay? And this is really where I sit comfortably. Disengagement, which is, let's put the head in the sand and just pretend it's not going on out there. Let's just pretend that what we encounter are isolated instances and try and deal them on a case-by-case basis. And let's not formulate anything. Let's just pretend the world that we live in is still the world that I grew up in. And although that had issues, at least it was the same frame. You know, a lot of times, where we're at is about making us feel safe and secure, rather than really about the gospel of Jesus Christ. It was an incident I had when I was a young man, and I was maybe 21 years of age. I was studying theology. I was fairly zealous. I find it interesting in that story, the woman caught in adultery. Did you notice the writer adds that it was the old man that left first? I thought, isn't that weird? Why was it the old man that left first? Well, it's one of these stories which leaves us loads of questions. Why did the old man leave first? And maybe because life's easier if you're young. Certainly, there seems a much more straightforward black and whiteness in the world when you're young. And I had a very straightforward black and whiteness. And my friend came to stay. And my friend had been journeying in terms of Christianity with me. God had healed him amazingly. We had experienced what we call baptism in the Spirit at the same time. We had had a love for God. We had engaged in evangelism together. And you know, we'd kind of been on the same trajectory in terms of our Christian lives and things. But he'd come to Stirling University, no less. And this is the dark ages, you understand. And he had met a girl and he moved in with her. Uh-oh. And I was like, and he and his girlfriend were coming to stay with me. So I was like, how am I going to respond to this, all right? Now, I know you probably don't struggle with these things nowadays, but, you know, 25 years ago, in fact, I still struggle with these things today, all right? But I was like, what am I going to do? He's my best pal, but I'm a Christian. He's backslidden. He needs to know this. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take a stand. So when they arrived, I made it very clear that she was going to stay in this bedroom and he was going to stay in that bedroom and I was going to stay in the bedroom in between. And now, because that's Christian, you know. The upshot of that story was, my best friend never talked to me for another 20 years and never ever went anywhere near a Christian church again in terms of that duration. Now, here's the thing. I felt good about that. You know, I did. If you asked me, I'd say, hey, I did biblical morality there. You know, and they needed to, and he needed to know he was a backslider because he hasn't worked that out yet. But here's the question. What happened to the cause of the gospel? And did it really forward the cause of the gospel? Yeah, I did the letter of the law. I ticked the boxes. You know, I can stand up here and tell you, hey, you know, I was a safe, secure, good conservative evangelical in my response to that situation. And to be honest, you know, even today, if I had that same situation, I don't know how I'd respond. I might just respond in the same way because it still feels safe and secure. And it feels like I know that this is comfortable for me. But I sat and I still sit and I think, you know, where was the cause of the gospel in this? The story that we read, a woman is brought to Jesus and she's caught in adultery. And Jesus is confronted with the scenario. What are you going to do, Jesus? Now, we know what the Bible says about this. Jesus was as committed as anyone to the Bible. He was committed to biblical morality. In fact, he has thought it up. So there was a situation here where he's being asked, how do you respond? Now, the story tells us that Jesus sits and writes on the ground. Again, it's one of these questions you want to ask. What was Jesus writing on the ground? John never tells us. I'd love to know. Somebody suggested it was names and addresses. Others have asked the question, why was only the woman that was there and not the man? And but he wrote on the ground. And then he writes some stuff. And then he says, he is without sin. Throw the first stone. And then he writes again on the ground. What is Jesus writing? And then we see this remarkable, incredible response. The law said, the Old Testament said, the Old Testament was very clear that that woman should be stoned. If he didn't stone her, he was encouraging others. You know, you're allowing open season and adultery, aren't you? But Jesus chose not to. He turns to the woman and he says, where are your accusers? No one else condemns you. I don't condemn you either. Jesus was saying, this is one beggar telling another beggar where to find bread. And the response has to be governed by that. And there's something very significant in terms of this story. You see, the question here is, was adultery any more right in the New Testament than it was in the Old Testament? Was it? Of course not. That hadn't changed. So what was changing? Well, what changes is the response to it. How Jesus responded to sin. And people need to understand, and it's something, again, I wish we could dialogue more. It's that there is a distinction between an ethical and a pastoral response. Ethical is right and wrong. And I think some Christians, because they've been upset in terms of the pastoral thing, have gone into an ethical debate, and it's led them to places which I think are contrary to biblical teaching. Okay. However, there is very clearly a pastoral response. That is saying, we recognize this stuff is wrong. We're not compromising on whether we believe this stuff is right or wrong, but we're challenging ourselves and we're asking ourselves about how we respond to this wrong. Truth is that in terms of same-sex relationships, and again, I know there are various views within our own church, but I'm a conservative evangelical. I take the historic position of the church in terms of what should constitute marriage. I believe it should be between a man and a woman in a lifelong union. However, while saying that, I think the church has been horrific in the way that we have responded to individuals in terms of the situation. I think we should apologize over and over again to the way that we have responded to those struggling with same-sex attraction within our communities, because it has been diabolical. Now, you might want to think that makes me a liberal, but it doesn't. Because I'll tell you, I take sin seriously. But I question how we respond to these things. And the question that we face, or I struggle with, and this is when I was doing my doctorate, there was a man called Søren Kierkegaard, and he used to do thought experiments. And this is a thought experiment in the sense of I'm just explaining to you what I wrestle with. But I wrestle with the way that we respond to sin. How do you wrestle when your son or your daughter comes home and they say they're now in a same-sex relationship? You know, I know, and there are a lot of Christians I know that are dealing with this scenario. Now, I heard about one church where the person was actually working for the church. Their son intimated the intent to get married to his partner. And the church leader came and said, if you attend that wedding, we will seriously be looking at whether you continue to work in this church. You know. And you go, well, hey, he took a stand. You know, he ticked a box. We feel safe and secure. But where's the cause of the gospel? And is that a right response? You see, I have seen in various places just incident after incident where, don't get me wrong, I am questioning whether the sin is sin. I'm not questioning that we need to shift our ethical boundaries, and I'm conservative by nature. But I do question how we respond to these things. I've known people in churches who love God, who are committed to God as much as you and I are, but they're living with their partner. And maybe they've been living with their partner for 10 or 11 years, and their partner doesn't want to get married. Some phobia or whatever. And you sit there and you go, well, you can sit in church, but you can never be a member, you can never be baptized. You know, it's safe, it's secure. But I look at it and I think, is this the response? You know, I've known churches and I've been part of leadership teams in churches where we've had people who have had kids and have been living together for 15, 20 years and had three children. And we required that the man and woman separated and lived apart after they became Christians because we wanted to tick the box and feel safe. You know, and I sat there and I continued to sit there and I say, is this the response? Understand, I'm not saying it's not sin, but is this the way that we respond? You know, I had a young man that was struggling with his sexuality. And you know, he talked and I sent him to get some help and he got support and things, but he was really struggling with his sexuality. He became part of a church I was involved with. But he just found it really hard to walk the walk. And he found particularly an issue with gay pornography. And he constantly slipped up. And so the church said, well, as long as he hasn't got this totally sussed, he can't continue in membership within the church. And so he was taken out of membership. He then dropped out of the church. You know, we felt safe and secure. Now, what is it? What is it that troubles me so much in these stories? What is it that troubles me with the responses that I see in terms of the church? I just had a friend this week, and he had a situation where he was sort of on a trajectory back into the church. He'd been away from God for a while. He was on a trajectory coming back. He was wanting to get committed to God again. He wanted to get involved again. But he's been living with his partner for a number of years now. And sort of moving. There are issues in terms of getting married immediately or not, but moving in the right direction. And he was just asked to step down from being a member of a board, a trust, because of that situation. And again, the cause of the gospel goes out the window. You see, here's the thing about that young man that I was telling you about my friend. Jesus says it's about the heart. It's about our heart and our heart in relation to God. See, one of the things that's so scary about the Asher Decree is that it's addressing the heart. It's trying to say that we as the government can coerce how you think, what you believe, and you must reflect these things because the state says so. And it's attacking the heart. One of the great things about Baptist thinking is that we affirm the importance of the heart. I always think of the Nicky Gumbel illustration of this child who wouldn't sit down in the car seat. And mum says, sit in the car seat. She says, no, sit in the car seat. She goes, no, sit in the car seat, no. And the child, eventually mum gets out of the car, puts the child into the car seat, locks her in and says, stay there, and jumps in the front. And the little girl goes, I might be sitting down, but I'm standing up in my heart. And you see, that's the essence of kind of Baptist impulse, which is, it's about the heart, people. It's the New Testament impulse. It's about the heart. And you might have outward conformity, but if in your heart you're dead, then you're as far away from God. Jesus said this about prostitutes and tax collectors. He said the prostitutes and tax collectors are entering the kingdom of heaven before you are. And how can he say that? Because if you look at the ticking the box exercise on their lives, the Pharisees certainly got a lot of ticks and the prostitutes and tax collectors didn't. So how does that work? And the reason he says that is because their hearts are orientated towards God. They're moving towards God. And I believe that as we come to Christian morality, it affirms the cross of Jesus Christ and that we come to the cross of Christ and then it looks at the heart. And it's about discerning the heart. It's about discerning the trajectory. You see, the love of God moves us towards holiness. We should have a love of God that is so consuming that it begins to transform us. And I believe that if your heart is orientated towards God, there will start to come transformation. There's a church, in fact, we have the speaker coming here in January at a conference, and their slogan is, "Come as you are." In other words, you're totally acceptable because you're acceptable to God based on the cross of Jesus Christ. But don't stay as you are, because God calls us to transformation. He calls us to biblical conformity. And if our hearts are touched by God, that love of God moves us towards Him. It becomes an all-consuming love. I really don't believe that Christians help ourselves in terms of sexual ethics, where we begin to call wrong right. Okay? And if anybody thinks I'm saying that this morning, let me just repeat that again. I do not believe that we help anyone by calling wrong right. I believe the statement that my favorite cartoon, which is of a man trying to break the Ten Commandments, and the cartoon saying, "We don't break God's laws break us." And if we choose to reject God's laws, it has terrible consequences for us. Hear me out. But I believe, thirdly, that holiness is always partial. It's always partial. You know, when we come to the cross of Jesus and we commit our heart to following Jesus and we begin to follow Him, you know, the fact is our holiness is always partial. St. Augustine explained that's why you have to pray every day the Lord's Prayer. Forgive us our sins, because you're going to be sinning. You're going to be failing. And what we do is we create this notion that some sins are worse than others. It's okay that you can give your life over to materialism. It's okay that you can give your life to the marginalization of sectors of our society. It's okay that you can do certain things. You can watch pornography in private. But goodness gracious, if we have sins that are publicly expressed that are of this sort or that sort, well, game over. Baptism and membership is seriously, seriously problematic. You see, we've created a way of defining holiness which actually conforms to our patterns. And again, there are situations not a thousand miles away from us, where I look at them and I go, how do we solve this? Because the issue isn't just a moral issue. It's not even that these people are bad. The issue is that they've just made a whole series of wrong choices, got their lives in such a mess. And my middle-class morality is sitting there going, why can't you just do wife and 2.2 kids and Ford Mondeo and come to church and become a member? Why can't everybody be like that? But then I look at the heart and I look at the trajectory. What's the upshot of the story? What am I trying to say? What is the way forward? Well, the way forward is not to back down on right and wrong. But I do believe the way forward is to affirm the cross of Jesus Christ and understand that we all come before the cross and that we are saved not because of our righteousness, but because of what Christ has done. I believe we need to have a way of discerning better the heart and the trajectory in which people are on. And I believe we need to ask ourselves what serves the cause of the gospel. You know why? Because I think when Jesus was confronted with that woman caught in adultery, that's what he did. Because, and maybe you can tell me afterwards, because we can have dialogue if you think I'm wrong. Because I can't work out any other way with why Jesus would turn to that woman and say, "I don't condemn you," when put in that situation. Let's pray. Lord Jesus, I just pray about this stuff we've been talking about this morning. Lord, I thank you that you are a holy God and that you take sin seriously. And Lord, I pray that you would make us a people who take sin seriously. Lord, I pray that you would make us a people who actually so love you and are so consumed with you that we don't want anything that offends you. Anything that represents less than what you want for us. Lord, I pray that you give us that consuming passion in our lives. Lord, I pray for all of us and the situations that we find ourselves in, maybe as a result of bad choices, maybe as a result of things that have happened in our lives. Lord, I just ask that you would work in those situations to move us towards what you call us to be. And Lord, I pray as a church that you would give us your heart and that we would have wisdom and the discernment of your spirit as we address ourselves to our changing world. I ask this in your name. Amen.